Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789 and text us at the same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we've been talking about the military budget, and I want to just touch on this before we move on. And this was an article in The Nation this morning by Mr. Andrew J. Bakovich. Unapologetic. America's militarism will be its downfall. Unapologetic and unembarrassed by its string of recent failures, the war party is once again climbing back into the saddle. I recently participated in a commemoration of Martin Luther King's address Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence, originally delivered on April 2nd, 1967, at New York City's Riverside Church. King used the occasion to announce his opposition to ongoing war in Vietnam, although a long time coming in the eyes of some of the anti-war movement. His decision was one for which he was roundly criticized, even by supporters of the civil rights movement. He was straying out of his prescribed lane. This goes back to, Sandy, what you have been saying about the fact that in this nation, we're all supposed to come together on one accord when it comes to war, right? I remember you saying...
Well, yeah, foreign affairs.
Yeah.
It's bipartisan. We've been taught that foreign affairs, and particularly war, is a time to have bipartisan unison. Unity, and that there's really it's unpatriotic to try to debate issues associated with it, and maybe that made sense during World War II when things were so clear cut, and we tried to make it that made sense during the Cold War. Although when you look backwards and historians look back at the Cold War, they shake their head and wonder how in the world we sustained 50 years of tension. Based on sort of the mutual paranoia that was stoking the Cold War, and now here we're at it again, and now, however, we're picking and choosing. We've got multiple places where we jump in and spend enormous sums of money. How much debate was there in advance for the Afghanistan adventure that ended up costing $1 trillion? You know, that's a huge sum of money to spend, and it's a huge sum of money that took away from the opportunity to balance Social Security, to have child daycare, to have health care for all, to spend money in the ways that Tom from California would talk about how the people deserve to get some money. And, you know, Vietnam was a situation in which it took several years for the American public to wake up and see, but that was a circumstance in which the American public put the brakes on the military and put the brakes on that war machine and changed things. And I think there was, for a period of time during the 70s, after the end of Vietnam, some constraint on the military's capacity to spend unlimited sums of money. And we did go through a period of non-adventure for some period of years after Vietnam, although there were some that happened under the radar, right? South America. We'd do stuff in South America, and we'd only find out about it after the fact.
Well, you know, Sandy, the media played a major role in that. They wound up ending the draft because people saw that. And that was, again, once what you're talking about, where people stood up.
Well, you know, I kind of wonder now in retrospect, because I think ending the draft was a mistake because it made it much more possible to sell militarism to the United States, because everyone wasn't going to be touched by it. Only people who volunteered to be touched by it were going to be touched by the militarism. And I kind of wonder whether the decision to end the draft, in spite of the fact that it was a liberal hue and cry, let's, you know, end the draft, wasn't maybe a cynical move by people in the Pentagon and people who supported the notion of the military budget being unlimited, a view that's what they wanted to accomplish. Let's get the body politic out of being worried about our military, and let's go to a volunteer military. And now the volunteer military is strongly supported by conservatives.
Yeah, you know, Sandy, just because somebody volunteers does not mean that we shouldn't be cautious where we send them. And in that you send them into these theaters of war. You know, I think it's easier now because, you know, people who wind up, you watch all these different...
Well, during Afghanistan, interestingly, I think there was at one point an analysis of how many members of Congress
had
children who were involved in the conflict, and it was, you could count it on one hand. So, you know, that's what I mean by not being touched by it. When you're touched at home by it, it has a far bigger impact in terms of having an impact in the political world. I think clearly we should take great care as to where we send our military, and regardless of whether they're volunteer or not. But when such a limited number of families are touched by it, and maybe the political leanings of those who are touched by it have been predetermined to some extent because the volunteer process might be more enthusiastically undertaken by people of particular political leanings.
And generally, the middle class and the poor
are
the ones. And in many instances, you know, poor people say that, you know, this is an opportunity for us to have a life in this country and to be respected, and so they join the military. And I'm not going to say I haven't told young people or talked to young people who don't know where they want to go, what they want to do. The military can be a learning ground for young people who and discipline and those kinds of things.
It was for when there was a draft, it was just exactly that for a large number of people.
Right.
And so, you know, I do think that compulsory national service is something that we ought to be looking at, and that much of the advanced countries in the world
Before they're 18. By the time they're 18,
and it has an impact on the level of community commitment that people have, because of the fact that they actually spend a period of their time working for the community, for the public.
And then, you know, in most instances, those people aren't sent off to some major war. They use it as discipline and teaching young people in Germany and other places. It's mandatory. You're Russia and other places, mandatory. You're going to wind up... I don't know. It might be the same in France and other places.
Oh, it's mandatory in many, many countries. It's mandatory in Norway. It's mandatory in Switzerland, I believe. It's commonplace that the advanced countries, the advanced economies, and the advanced societies have mandatory national service. And, you know, it's a very positive impulse in the social, economic, political structure of those countries.
If it's used properly, you know, in our country, you know, you don't know, you know, you hesitate.
Well, but what I'm saying is that having it broadly experienced like that has a moderating influence on the military adventurism of a country. Okay, having conscripts.
Right.
Having the notion of conscripts, which is what draftees are, right? People
right.
who are forced into the military, has a moderating impact politically.
So let me, last thing on military. The American media's approach to war coverage needs to be fundamentally reimagined. We need more reporting on forgotten conflicts and more stories that spotlight how war ravages people and leads to atrocities. You've kind of said that.
Yeah, I mean, war. People ought to understand that when wars start, terrible things happen. It's a rule. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not the exception. It's the rule.
You know, and I'm constantly hearing, you know, the atrocities. It's what we're hearing constantly in Ukraine, but people are just now.
Well, interestingly. The world looks at wars, the world that isn't participating in the war looks at wars, and the people who are killed are the victims of atrocity. The people who are involved in the war, there's two sides to every outcome that involves atrocities. One is a victory, and one is a loss.
Kill or be killed.
And the victors don't ever talk about the atrocities. So the United States, in all of our wars, we read about the battles we've won. We read about the cities that we've vanquished. We don't see the atrocities that are what a third-party observer would say is happening in each of those situations.
You know, Sandy, we've got to stop thinking war is inevitable. When you look at this whole situation from the, you know, perspective of war is inevitable, we've got to be prepared because there's going to be war. Well, you know, I don't know. And many other nations, you know, that don't look at it from that perspective. They've tried, especially at NATO, pared things down before they've been forced to ramp up again. Those nations had enough of that. You know, the same thing Japan did after World War II. Japan basically, based on maybe some nudging from our country, said we aren't going to be ramping up for war anymore. And look at what they were able to do, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. You know, we criticize the NATO countries, Trump did, for not spending enough of their GDP. You know, would that we could.
Right.
You know, not spend as much of our GDP. And the only reason we do is because we have a war planning process that involves being able to fight wars on three fronts and to dominate the world. And, you know, we make assumptions that require that we spend enormous amounts of money on our defense.
All right, got to go to the break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy was talking about the war. I didn't know. So May 9th is Victory Day in Russia. What does that mean?
Well, the armistice, the peace of when Germany surrendered on, it was May 8th in Germany, but due to the time zone, it was May 9th in Russia. So we view it as May 8th. Russians view it as May 9th. And it's the day that the Great War, as they would call it, ended.
Yeah.
And from the Russian standpoint, they basically won that war. They're the ones who brought Germany to their knees. They're the ones who exhausted the German resources in the war. And so for them, it's a very, very big celebration.
So it would be safe to say if they could make Ukraine surrender anywhere near around that day, symbolically, it would be a great victory for them, right?
Well, yeah, and I think our Pentagon folks
not gonna allow it.
No, they're suggesting that's what Putin wants to do is to come up with some kind of a victory. Whether it's, I don't think he could contemplate that Ukraine as a whole would surrender by then, but that maybe he could cement the Mariupol, the land corridor running from the Donbas region and Russia. Around to Crimea and announce the annexation of that, as well as some finalization of the status of the Donbas region, which maybe would then he could announce was all he was seeking in the war as in the first place, and he could announce victory with that. And I think the Pentagon is beginning to think that that's where he's headed, but who knows? We prognosticate, although I have to say the intelligence apparatus is pretty good at prognosticating the invasion of Ukraine and a number of steps since then. So,
you know, Sandy, part of this is too late to be turned around. Mariupol is, you know, for all intents and purposes, that's going to be Russia's.
Well, I think that, you know, like I've said, I think that the outcome of this war was pretty clear in the beginning. I think the outcome of the negotiation was pretty clear when Russia had Ukraine surrounded with troops and hadn't started the invasion, which was that the Donbas region would be somehow recognized as being not a formal part of Ukraine anymore, whether it would be independent or annexed by Russia, that the annexation of Crimea would be recognized by Ukraine. I think the only thing in the war that might change is this land bridge that includes Mariupol. going along the Black the Sea of Azov down to Crimea. And so that might be the one ingredient that has been added to this in terms of what Putin might have gained beyond what would have been negotiated. But I do think that that's the probable outcome of this. And I don't know what happens after that in terms of the sanctions with Russia or the treatment of Russia by the international community. But I do think that Zelensky has already sent signals that he's willing to negotiate right over the Donbass and Crimea.
You know, Sandy, and I think the American people are starting to get weary of it. They're not, things are going back to normal in people's lives because they've kind of gotten used to. Now they're talking about this major burial plot and all those things. But like you always say, it's what happens in war. What, you know, they murdered a lot of people.
Well, I think I don't know whether the American public, I mean, I think the news cycle is such that unless they come up with new things to announce, like these mass graves right in Mariupol, you know, they it gets repetitive. So the news media keeps trying to find new things. Atrocities make headlines, so they label everything they find on the battlefield an atrocity. And quite frankly, everything on a battlefield is an atrocity. I just don't know whether all of them are Geneva Convention atrocities. But I do think that the fallout from the war is going to be experienced in this country for some while. I think the rise in food price, commodity prices, I think the rise in energy cost, commodity prices are going to be with us for some while. I think the slowdown in the world economy, I mean, the world economy was slated to grow at 6.1% last year. It's projected to grow at 3.6% this next year. So that's a significant reduction in the growth rate of the economy, mostly attributable to the problems that are coming out of this war and the inflation associated with it. And now we've got a central bank policies, our Federal Reserve and other central bank policies, ready to move interest rates up, mortgage rates up, and it's going to be a squeeze that's going to grab the attention of us, whether it's written in the newspaper or simply written at the grocery store on the prices.
You know, Sandy, no matter how you want things to be normal, you know, things aren't always normal, right? I mean, how many things remain normal? And if you live long enough, you know that there are going to be things that happen in the society that's out of our control. And you just know that there's not much you or I can do about it. You just have to deal with the issues that you can and try to make the nation where you live better. That's kind of how I look at it. You know, certainly I wish things were better in different parts of the world. We have the ability, if we don't, you know, spend those resources and others on the military aspects of these things. But, Sandy, I just don't know if these things are ever going to change, man. They haven't changed in my lifetime.
Well, human nature and society is comprised of human beings, and the human nature has the effect of, I think, infecting us with this tendency for warfare, and it's a horrible thing. We had it. We keep having impulses, political movements. You know, NATO was in fact, in large part, designed to keep Europe from fighting amongst themselves, which was the source of warfare for the 1800s primarily, and it has accomplished that outcome until now, and now it's not really fighting amongst itself. We have the Eurasian continent, essentially the eastern part of the Eurasian continent, which culturally has been different than the western part for hundreds of years, and now we're finding that we can fight amongst ourselves in that fashion, and we're not smoothing that out. We're not using diplomacy to try and smooth the feathers and smooth the paranoia that is what leads to warfare. We seem to be fanning those flames, and did fan those flames. And obviously, we fanned the kindling into an outright fire, bonfire.
You know, Sandy, we've got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be back. Show is always you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. And Tom is back from L.A. Hey, Tom, what's going on, man?
Carol, I was about to start. We the people are the government, and I am a proud FDR Democrat. You know, when you guys are talking about the media, and talking about a conflict of interest, some of these media sources and some of these media companies aren't just doing media. They're also defense contractors. So basically, the media or the news that you're getting on NBC, the news that you're getting potentially on CNN,
how are they defense contractors, Tom? I'm not familiar with the portion of which corporations.
Well, between the tech and the U.S. military, in terms of what it is that they can actually, you know, get away with. I mean, there was an article about the thousands of contracts that highlight the quiet ties between big tech and the U.S. military. You look at AT&T and AT&T. You know, buying CNN. It all starts to become too much where one company
I think CNN is owned by a private equity firm now, isn't it?
No, they're owned by AT&T.
They were just acquired.
AT&T is who owns CNN right now at the present. But what I'm saying to you is this. When you own something, you should not be allowing that to affect other parts of things that you own. So, yes, when Brian Williams is sitting on the news and saying, oh, how great those Scud missiles look, and wow, look at that. Don't tell me that they don't have some type of ulterior motive to get us into more war and get us into more conflicts and that they're not getting some type of payday over it. Of course they are. NBC Universal was a defense contractor in the George War criminal Bush era. So, I mean, this is something that we need to also be looking at when we're looking at our media. We need to be looking at it and you know, looking at it and having an open eye to exactly, you know, following the money because of the fact that when you follow the money, then all of a sudden you'll start finding out where all of these, reasons why it is that you're not just getting the who, what, when, why, where of one-on-one journalism, you're, you know, getting more than that. I mean, here's another article. American firms rule the $398 billion global arms industry. Here's a roundup of the world's top defense contractors by sales. And it's got all the different contractors here.
Tom, there's no question that that's what we're talking about. The military-industrial complex has far, far too much influence in the whole American political process. And you're right that I think AT&T Discovery owns CNN. That's owned by
actually Discovery just bought Time Warner.
Yeah, and Time. That's right. And through Discovery, AT&T has ownership to.
Yep.
Time. So
that's the problem. There's too much monopoly.
But one of the problems we've got with news generally is we've lost the professional cadre of journalists.
Hey Tom, thank you for the call.
And we also are all victims of the need to have high ratings, and so news tends to cover things that have high ratings, and unfortunately, warfare is it's good to sell.
Sandy, I want to talk about this article. Western-led globalization might end, but the new globalization might have an Eastern face. We've learned in this nation that globalization is a dirty word because of the industrial jobs that were lost during globalization. And, those like myself who were in industry saw our jobs leave and move overseas, and China was one of the first places that they went. And so we became angry at China, as if China came and physically took the jobs. Not that the laws were created by our government that made it possible for corporations to move overseas. That China didn't just come in here and say, hey, we're going to take all those jobs.
No, actually, China didn't take them.
Our country moved.
we gave them
yes,
to China.
Right.
No, I mean, globalization is not reversible, okay? Globalization is going to happen because the alternative to globalization, if we were going to really shut down the borders and have each country onto itself in terms of its mercantile activities, its commercial activities, first of all, the growth rate of the world would slow way down. And the growth rate in the United States would probably stagnate because we are not a growing economy. And much of our growth has happened because of globalization and the capacity of America to sell its products around the world. Do we think that we can shut our border down so that everything is made here and everyone else won't shut their border down so that we can't sell our stuff there? I mean, that's what the end of globalization would look like, and it would be have a very detrimental impact on our economy, on the world economy, on our standard of living, on inflation and the ability to control inflation as we move towards this globalized economy. So it's not a train that we can stop. It's a freight train that won't stop. And what we're doing now is moving in the direction of making sure that the time when China becomes the heart of the globalized world economy will advance in time. My view is that China is going to be one of the dominant economies in the globalized world, regardless of whatever we do. And the notion that we should paint China as an enemy because they have this robust commercial enterprise and growth rate going is to move ourselves back to 1750 when countries used to war with one another over mercantile matters.
You know, Sandy, I remember when, again, the corporations started moving overseas, and I remember when the company that I was working at made their decisions to move. I also remember when Harley Davidson said, we're going to move, a lot of the work over to China. And initially, my instinct said, well, why are they doing that? Why would they do that? But then common sense set in. There's 320 million Americans or so.
Yeah.
And if I'm Harley Davidson, 320 million Americans, how many of those Americans actually want to purchase motorcycles?
Sure.
But now, if I look at China and however many billion people, and it doesn't make sense to make the motorcycles in America that we're going to sell in China because of what cost is added to that when I can just put up a plant in China or they'll put one up for me.
Or India.
Or India. Mm-hmm. And so when you really think about it, it makes sense.
Well, of course it does.
I know.
I mean, that's the thing. Globalization makes all the sense in the world. And it has a huge economic impact on the world. It does have a frictional impact on jobs in various parts of the world. And we, the American manufacturing machine that had high-paying middle-class jobs, has been the one to suffer the most from globalization. Right. There have been many economies in the world who have thrived as the result of globalization, Vietnam, China. China's built a substantial middle class. All one has to do is travel any place in the world and see the busloads of Chinese tourists who get out and travel and have the money, just as Americans have money to travel, so do the Chinese. And the notion that China is producing everything they produce in sweat factories with underpaid people who aren't middle class defies the reality of the very rapidly growing middle class in China.
Yeah, and the fact that there's so many Chinese.
Yes.
You know, the sheer numbers means that their middle class is going to dwarf our middle class.
Sure, it's already approaching in size, I'm sure, in terms of millions of people who are participating at a middle class level in their economy. I'm sure they are approaching in size the same numbers of millions of people as we have, and it's only a fraction of their total population because they've got a great deal of growth potential inside their country.
So many citizens in our country want our nation to basically undo what was done, and that's never going to happen. It doesn't matter how we feel about it. That's never going to happen. And so in this article, that's basically what they are saying. If we don't want to be a part of globalization, then China's going to step in. They're already there.
Well, China is stepping in. And the question is, how are we going to figure out how we can participate in the world economy to prosper? And like I've said before, we don't need to dominate the world economy to be the most prosperous portion of that world economy. Right now, for instance, one of the most prosperous countries in the world is Norway, right? They don't dominate. If you look at, I think the American per capita GDP is fourth or fifth in the world. There are numbers that are ahead of us who are doing just fine without dominating the world economy. We would like to keep the dollar as the world currency, and we can do that even if China is a more dominant player in the economy. If we don't do things that make it less likely that the dollar is the world currency. We just did something that made it less likely that it would be when we froze the Russian, the central bank assets of Russia and made the dollar the source of essentially political activity.
So China is, again, now looked at as our enemy, and people in this nation who don't know any better. Because, where are they going to find that out? You know, if Sandy wasn't appearing on these airwaves, I got to be honest with you, I wouldn't be thinking about it.
If China, incidentally, if China is our enemy, Katie bar the door for how much our military expenditures will have to be in the long run, because China, with its economy, has a far greater military potential than Russia. It hasn't yet decided to flex its muscle in that direction, but it's beginning to. And why is it beginning to? I would say it's because we have decided that we've started declaring China to be our enemy.
You know, that part of it really came heavily with Donald Trump when he declared, once he got in office. And right. I don't know, maybe there were those of us who lost jobs and as you stated, heard all of the, they were stealing our
technology.
Our technology things.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that it's communist, except that it's really very much not a communist, it's got a hybrid of communist and capitalism going that actually has proven itself to be quite effective, which maybe is what scares us the most.
We got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be back.
Good morning. from the Waukesha County Labor Council. We are the men and women who work in Waukesha County who belong to many local unions, including AFSCME, cement masons, electricians, insulators, food and commercial, laborers, operators, painters, machinists, transit, sheet metal, and steel workers. Our union contract provides a voice in the workplace, great wages, and important benefits. To learn what your work is really worth, call 262-468-8293.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is here. And you know, Sandy, if we, your and my generation, doesn't understand China, it's going to be difficult for our loved ones who are here after us, right? I mean, if they take the same stance that you're in my generation is taking on China as the enemy, there's no way that they're going
to
win.
Well, it's sometimes hard to reverse that course, right? When you like the Cold War. I mean, if we end up getting the world re-separated into Cold War kinds of environment. Now, I think it's going to be harder to have a Cold War with China because of the massive extent to which we are intertwined with them right now. We would have to undo, and our industry would have to undo such a massive number of interconnections and entwinements that it will be harder to accomplish. We don't have anything like that going on with Russia, unfortunately, because I think if we had that, I think the whole situation with Russia and the Ukraine would probably not have happened. So, because that's one of the outcomes of globalization is it's very hard to disconnect, okay? And so that's one thing that makes me hopeful. But I think that the whole way that we approach our discussion about China and our discussions with China and the hardened way we deal with it creates the similar response.
Now, I've had a couple of guys ask me, why is Sandy always talking about China? And I said, well, Sandy's been to China. And so, you know, you didn't see them as your enemy when you were there, did you?
Well, no, but I mean, I don't think when you get into a country, you never see any country as your enemy because it's all just a bunch of people. And there's no question that China's culture is different than ours, just like Japan. When I was in Japan, I was more struck by the difference in the Japanese culture from us than I was from the Chinese culture. But, oh, yeah, I mean, China's different. I mean, in China, everyone runs wherever they go. You go to a store and you ask for something, and the clerk turns around and then runs to go do what you've asked him to do. And it's clearly a very high work ethic country. But the main thing I know about China is what I read about it and try to study about what's going on in the world and to try and understand how the country runs itself. And, you know, we have to understand that a country with 1.3 billion people has a far different problem associated with running itself, particularly when it's an emerging country. It's not an already fully developed country. It's in the last 35 years, it has emerged from almost third world status into leading first world status. And so the question is, what kind of different political processes are necessary in order to accomplish that?
Which is really an amazing feat in 35 years to have accomplished what they've accomplished. If you extrapolate that out to another 35 years,
Well, let me tell you, that extrapolation is the very reason why there's this impetus in the United States to call them the enemy, because the view is that in that 35-year span, they will move beyond the United States in terms of being a dominant player in the world economic stage. And my point is, well, that's the freight train. You know, that's the freight train we can't stop. But what do we do to make that into lemonade? Because it's not even a lemon necessarily unless we view it as a lemon. Do you think the rest of the world would need to consider the United States as the boogeyman and the enemy? Unfortunately, we're making that possible by the way we're behaving around the world, running around and basically telling the world how to behave and what to do. But we could be, and basically have been, a very benign force in the world or should be a very benign force in the world. And if we were, we wouldn't be hated because of our dominant commercial position.
You know, China has, and the United States has a history. And it's not really good for the Chinese people. If you go back, we've done some things historically in China, right?
Yeah, well, Western Europe and the United States have definitely played with China in the past. In the 1800s, yeah, there's some sad stories to tell.
Right, and the Chinese people, they haven't forgotten. I mean, you know.
Well, I don't know about that. I think, you know, just like the Vietnamese, you would think that the Vietnamese people would hate Americans, but if you go to Vietnam, you find out quickly that they're very, very friendly and embrace.
Well, because the people, they're basically one of the youngest nations on earth in Vietnam.
Well, I guess we made sure that happened.
Yeah.
Right?
It's not funny, but we wiped out, you know, the elders there in Vietnam, and so those are basically it's a young nation.
Yeah, but my point is that China is a very irresistible force economically. They have everything they need to be a very, very big player in the world
stage.
And
there's nothing we can do to stop
that. And if what we do is spend all of our energy trying to stop it or putting ourselves in opposition to it, we will create an environment in which we will be the loser, and the world will be the loser, and our grandchildren will be losers as the result of it. It will cost us a great deal of treasure to build up this military might that would be necessary to square off against their military might. They will squander a bunch of money on military in the same fashion, and the world will not develop at the rate at which it could, and we will have problems in our country, because if we decide it's a standoff, then they can take positions in the future that could endanger us materially. And I don't mean militarily, I mean economically. If we want to give up the dollar as the world currency, the way to do that is to get very arm's length with China and to make sure that China takes a view that it's important that we be reduced to rubble economically.
So let me ask you, with where we are now, and Joe Biden and his group, they're not opposed to China right now, are they? I mean, they're not pushing strongly.
Well, you know, we've gotten to the same point that we did, you know, with the USSR and communism. We still label China, you know, the people who want to do this label them as a communist country. The people who don't just talk about China. And I think that you can see that it's now becoming mandatory from a political standpoint to have China painted as a bad guy. And we find it on both sides of the aisle, both sides talking about how it is we have to take a very aggressive approach to China. We have to worry about what China's next move will be. And all of that is really a self-fulfilling prophecy that is unnecessary. We are in a position, in the alternative, to stay very intertwined with China, to take mutual advantage of one another in this commercial process, to maintain the U.S. dollar as the world currency, which is incidentally vital to the position of the United States with respect to our current economy.
So there's enough booty in the world for the United States and China, right? Is that what you're basically saying?
Absolutely. And you know, we can be if we organize ourselves to have a vibrant economy, if we create the kind of economy that exists in Germany, if we set up a social safety net, have a well-trained workforce, get ourselves into the most adaptable position possible to have a very adaptable economy, we will be very successful on the world stage, and we will have a higher average per capita GDP than China forever.
All right, we've got to go to the break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back.